Next week, I'm going to go back to the beginning of Luke and bring a little bit more coherence to the arc that we've been part of here. And I'm going to put this little chart, graph, whatever you want to call it, up on the wall. And I was going to do it for this week, but I feel like it's probably better to keep it not start in the middle of the chart, to do from the beginning, and then we can fill this out later. So in this little, the sermon is actually coming through from 18 and going all the way to the end of chapter 9. And in this section, we have a whole series of vignettes or scenes. And the thing that strikes me is that when you back up and look at it, there are some key words that keep showing up. And one of them is, like in verse 10, on their return, the apostles. So you get this motion, right? And it's the apostles have been sent out, right? They were sent out to preach, teach, and heal. And they've come back and they give their report to Jesus and so forth. And then in 18, verse 18, it starts with once. We don't have a time frame for 18 and what follows. And then in 28, it says time reference. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, so time frame, right? And then in 37, on the next day, and then you get to the next little section, you've got in 43, and all were astounded at the greatness of God. This is after Jesus has cast out a demon. And then it says, while everyone was amazed at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples. So again, you get this immediacy, you get these time references, and you get this sense of this whole section is really meant to be looked at as one little unit that's tied together by teaching, by miracles, by interventions by the disciples, and by Jesus responding to them, either to correct them or to sharpen the sense of things. Okay, so when I get the chart, if this were the chart here, and it's different, the different verses are laid out, what I'll do with this thing is there's the description, who, what, where, when, why, of what the event is, and each of these is a little event. But then there's the question here, what happens? What exactly happens? Is it Jesus who's doing something? Is it the disciples who are doing something? Is it, do they succeed? Do they understand? Or are they wrong? And how does Jesus respond to it? So this is actually a time where we have to step back again, because remember, he sent the 12 out. The 12, right? At the beginning of chapter 9, he sends the 12 out. They come back to him, and while they're out and about, they're doing what? Preaching, teaching, healing. So the disciples are actually doing miracles, right? They're preaching, they're teaching, they're healing, just as Jesus sent them out to do. And they come back. And what they do is they say, they told Jesus all that they had done. That's verse 10. And I jumped over the fact that Herod Herod has been seeing all these, you know, he's heard about Jesus, and now there are the 12. They're going out, and they're preaching, teaching, healing. And he's saying, what's going on with this? Who is this Jesus person? So at the beginning of this section, before the feeding of the 5,000, you have Herod asking the question that Jesus comes to ask the disciples later, right? See, Jesus says, who do they say that I am? Just like Herod has been saying, who is this guy? I beheaded John, but who is this guy? So in the context of this chapter 9, we have a bunch of different questions about the Jesus identity. We have a bunch of questions about what the disciples do, what Jesus does, how he corrects them, and how he teaches them all along. And throughout the chapter, it keeps saying things that, like, as they were going along the road. So that's where the title comes from. So these, if you expand that title, it's Jesus teaching his disciples along the way, right? So the, and I'll try to stop saying right. I don't know why I'm saying right today, but kind of drives me crazy when other people do it. So I'll try and stop myself. I don't know why. Oh my. So then what's taking place here is the question. What is taking place? Jesus has just fed the 5,000. And remember from last 2 weeks ago, in the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples identified the problem. They came to Jesus and they said, send these people away. It's been a long day. They've been tired, so forth. My image is that the disciples really were jealous of Jesus because they had been out preaching, teaching, healing. Now they come back all full of themselves, and Jesus says, hold the phone. Hold the phone. This isn't about you. We need to auto-correct here a little bit. We need to rethink what's going on here. And so Jesus, there's the event of feeding the 5,000, where Jesus fills their baskets and sends them out, but they come back, they have to get their baskets full. So Jesus is demonstrating to them that they have to be resourced by him on a regular basis. That's part of the lesson that he's told, teaching them. But then we get to this question that Jesus puts to them. What do the crowds say that I am? Who do the crowds say that I am? And again, this echoes what happened a few verses later, because Herod says, John I beheaded, right? John the Baptist. Now Jesus is saying, asking them, and the disciples say, well, some people think you're John resurrected. Some people think you're Elijah, come back. Others think that you must be some other prophet. Then Jesus says, I too will die. I made this reference last week about cults and so forth. For me, when I think about this section here, and then there are several different references where Jesus talks about his death and resurrection, there's a sense in which he's trying to get them to understand that I'm not trying to turn this into something based on me. I'm not trying to turn this into some kind of cult of Jesus, right? This is the cult where the idol figure disappears, dies, doesn't take power, doesn't seize power, doesn't make himself up to be a king or mighty ruler in that sense. So in this, that second story, in what we read today, it's Jesus talking about his death, and then immediately following that, 8 days later, there's this story where He goes up on the hill, and then there's a cloud that comes down on the hill, and it's reminiscent of what happens when John the Baptist baptized Jesus, right? The Spirit of God says, "This is my son, this is my beloved," and confirms who Jesus is. So when it comes to identity, Jesus there says, confirms what Peter has confessed, "You are the Messiah of God." But for Peter, Messiah is really like exalted king. So that's one image of God. But then Jesus says, "No, hold the phone. I'm not the exalted king in the way you're thinking of it. I'm going to suffer and die. I'm not going to take over. I'm not going to rule this country, this kingdom. I'm not revisiting David, you know, kingship and that model." He says, "No, I'm not doing that." But Peter and James and John are up there on the mountain with Jesus. The Elijah is there and Moses is there and Jesus, and they want to, Peter says, "Let's build booths." Jesus says, "No, that's not what this is about." And the Spirit of God speaks. And then all three, Jesus remains, but the other two, Elijah and Moses, have left. So, sorry, I'm, these stories are so full of other details, and we'll get into those at another time. But I'm wanting to present the arc of things, so I'm just referencing stories that are familiar most of the time, but it's kind of unfair to expect them to be so familiar. But the point of it is that Jesus is shaping, is trying to, there are things that are pointed out, events that happen that make people think he's going to fit into this mold of David, that kind of Messiah. And Jesus is consistently correcting them and saying, "No, that's not what this is about." So if we go back to this chart image I had, you know, do the disciples understand what's happened? Here they say, you get a no. Jesus sharpens it. How does he sharpen it? So it's this dialogue back and forth between the event and Jesus and the disciples' understanding and Jesus' correction of that. So the next day, it says, in verse 37, Jesus comes down from this mountain experience. You know, we have mountaintop experiences at times. And, you know, like we even do things called honeymoons and things like that, where we want to hold on to this mountaintop, right? In a sense. And so we want to bask in this new marriage or this new event. Sometimes we have spiritual mountaintops and we want to just not get back into the nitty-gritty. Well, here Jesus has this mountaintop experience, and immediately as he descends, he's confronted by a man whose son keeps trying to self-destruct. And Jesus, the disciples have tried to heal the child, and Jesus says, "Hold on," and says, this is in other places, he says, this needs special prayer and fasting. But here he says, that Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. So there's another example where Jesus receives the child, blesses it, and returns it. He doesn't take the child away or anything like that. And when he does that, it says that all were astounded at the greatness of God. So they didn't They didn't, even though they had seen Jesus do it, who did they give credit to? God. You see? So this, in my thinking, throws us back to what happened with the disciples. They were out doing preaching, teaching, healing. They come back and they say, you should have seen what we did. So they're tying it to themselves. But here, even Jesus doesn't tie it to himself. He's doing these miracles, and it's clear to them, no, that this is all about God. This isn't about this man. See? So then Jesus immediately, while they were all amazed, he says to his disciples, those 12 who wanted to attribute everything to themselves, he says to them, look, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands, and they didn't understand it, saying its meaning remained concealed from them so that they could not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this saying. So the disciples couldn't understand it. Jesus says, the next little vignette, so they're still in this confusion about what's going on here, and they get into an argument about what? They get into an argument. Here we are, the 12. We're the head of this operation, right? So who among us is the greatest? Right? And what's Jesus's response? In Luke, Jesus's response is the children's story. You've got to be like little children. This isn't about you. This isn't about your position in power. This is about following me, following God's law, God's commands, in simpleness and in truth. Not coming from an orientation of what am I going to get out of it? What's my position going to be? And so on and so forth. So Jesus, again, is correcting his disciples. They present their understanding. Sometimes they're hesitant about it. Sometimes they say it straightforwardly. Then he gets to verse 49. Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. And we tried to stop him because he does not follow us. Think about that. They've just been talking about themselves, the 12, and their importance and their position and their power in this team, right? So they're caught up in their interests, and they want to be recognized for who is the greatest. Jesus says, no, that's not what this is all about. And then they say, but Master, there are people doing miracles in your name, and we try to stop them. Jesus says, what's the deal? You've understood nothing at all. Do not stop him, for whoever is not against you is for you. So Jesus is doing what? He's breaking down their sense of ownership of this ministry. Then it says, when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. So here it's again, it's a physical orientation, a physical reference. And they want to go and they want to stay in a Samaritan village. And the Samaritans don't want to receive them, don't want to offer hospitality. And they respond, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? So they're still full of their powers, right? That's a pretty bold statement. First they say, you're doing these miracles in in the name, they're doing these miracles in the name of Jesus, we need to shut them down. Now it's on the other side. Here, this Samaritan village doesn't want to give hospitality to you, so should we burn them down? Jesus says, no, forget about it. Let's just go on to another village. Let's forget the drama here. We don't have to destroy this place. But then he doesn't really leave this whole business alone, because now the next little bit, as they were going along the road, someone said to him, just some person, says, I will follow you wherever you go. Jesus doesn't say, oh, that's great, join the crowd. No, he says, following me, foxes, they have their dens. Animals, other things, have a place that's stable, steady. But the Son of Man, nowhere to lay his head. Somebody else says, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. I want to follow. He said, follow me. And the person said, first let me go and bury my father. That's normal, isn't it? To want to honor your father, your parents. Jesus says, no. Let the dead bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God. Pretty harsh. Another says, I will follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those at my home. Jesus said to them, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. So what's going on here? Jesus is first saying, don't tell everybody about the great things I'm doing, right? He says, don't mention these things. Keep them secret. Keep it quiet. Then when people come wanting to follow him, he redirects them. And he keeps going back to this story of having to die. And so if we think about this whole picture here between the sending out of the 12 in chapter 9 and now the sending out of the 72 in chapter 10, what we begin to realize here is Jesus is keeping the disciples from making this about themselves. Can you imagine how jealous they were that Jesus would have the audacity to say, okay, I've been walking very closely with you disciples here, and you're getting closer to understanding things here, but I'm going to send out 72 others, and I'm going to give them the exact same job that I gave you. Talk about a major diss. You think this is about you, but it's not about you. It's about me. Now, where are we supposed to go with this on this particular story or series of stories? Well, for one, for me, what it says is it harkens back to the Garden of Eden story, where Jesus is walking about in the garden and Adam and Eve hear him walking about in the garden. So Jesus created the world and made this space in which we could thrive. People can thrive. And Jesus wanted to walk alongside of Adam and Eve. So when we get to this series in Luke, we see Jesus is the one who came and pitched his tent among us and then didn't set it up to rule over us as a king would rule, but to be with us and accompany us along the road. So it's not the king that is over people, It's the king that is with people. And so Jesus is chiseling away, in a sense, at their understanding, their expectation of who God is and what God wants. Jesus is actually refining their sense and saying, you know, this isn't about you. It's about me. It's about preaching, teaching, healing, God's kingdom being proclaimed through both words and action. And it's about the journey that you have that, in a sense, presents a new world order that isn't based on authority as in worldly authority. It isn't based on nation states. It isn't based on all of these other things. It's based on right relationships. And that key relationship is the relationship with Jesus. So Jesus invites us to be a healing presence, and he joins us in the ministry. So that's sort of the first thing that I observe here. The second thing is that Jesus doesn't expect us to be perfect. No reaction there. So is that an obvious one? Is that obvious to you? I mean, I grew up, you know, I've mentioned losing my eye as a 7-year-old. You know what the biggest problem I had really in dealing with that is that how can I ever be perfect if I'm damaged goods? You know, and so I remember having nightmares or dreams, whatever, where, you know, I'd be spinning up to heaven and my eye would be restored. You know, I don't know if any of you, do you remember that movie, The Mission? There was a movie called The Mission, Robert De Niro, and it was about the conquest in Southern America and so forth. And he's a Catholic missionary. And there's one scene in which they're trying to reach this people group, as we would say today, that's upriver. So it's takes place down in Paraguay or I forget the name of that falls there. But there's this huge waterfall, and he climbs up the cliff, De Niro does, with this bag of vestments for the Catholic in order to do mass properly, right? He's climbing up there, and this bag that seems crucial to God's mission is really the thing that's holding him back. And when I was getting ready to leave the U.S. to go to Chad back in 1998, I remember talking to my dad about that movie, not 98, 78. Talking to my dad about that film. We had watched it together not too long before. And he said, "Steve, you know, I keep wondering when you're going to be free." And he alluded to this image about De Niro, the priest, climbing up the hill and carrying this bag. And my dad was, I think, thinking about all the agenda that I had. I felt pretty strongly that this was a country that was going straight down the tubes, that it was a bankrupt system, that there was so much corruption, the poor were being disenfranchised, and the rich were accumulating and taking everything. And I just felt like there's a sense in which I felt like I cannot thrive here. No, I cannot. So part of my motivation in going somewhere else was not pure by any means, right? But part of what my dad was identifying is that you're carrying such a burden, you're fleeing so much, that it's your burden that's likely going to be your destruction.
Yeah.
So in this set of stories, I feel like that's kind of how God has worked with me over the years. Because so much of the time, I'm so full of myself and my own agenda that, you know, that phrase, let go and let God, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but there's a sense in which that's saying all the time, Steve, so much of this is about yourself. So much about of this is about what you think you could do if the world would only recognize how great you are, you know? And so we take on all this agenda, all this responsibility, and we act as though we're the only thing that counts. But that's not trusting in God. This is God's world. This is God's mission. So how do we find that balance between doing what we are called to do, being what we are called to be, and at the same time recognizing that we need to empty ourselves, that we need to be like children when we come before God, and we need to let go of our agenda and simply be with God? I'm not there yet. It's a process. It's a long, chiseling process. One of these Sundays, I'm going to get the picture of some of Michelangelo's statues, the slaves they're called. And they're in Venice. And, you know, you've got the David there in Venice, which is a spectacular big statue, but then you also have the slaves and their incompleted works where Michelangelo has chipped away. And what you see is that there's this block, it's a column of marble, and he's gone right for their bodies. You know, their midsection, their torso. He's gone right for their torso, and he's chiseled away at that, but their feet are still in a block, and their hands must be up like this in the air, because they're a block in the air, you know? And you'd think he would have liberated the head, you know, or liberated the feet, but no, that hasn't happened. He died before the job got done, but there are at least three of them standing side by side, and they're called the slaves. Not because he intended them to be imprisoned, but because that's where he died. And I think for me, that's a lot of the way I see God is working with me, is that I have tons of rough edges, very rough edges. I get angry at the silliest points. And Dorothy just, you know, she doesn't roll her eyes. I don't know what she does, but she doesn't accept it anyway. But you know, we are always walking along the way. And if we think it's about ourselves and about our accomplishments and what we're supposed to be about, that's often where we're furthest from being who we're called to be. And so the question is, how do we set our own selves free of our own agenda and let God truly walk with us and shape us? So I'll leave it at that.